I hope this microphone helps in this small room. I'm sort of tempted to go without it. You know, I've got all these notes here. I hope they don't fall on the floor. It's just frightening to talk to other lawyers. I don't mind talking to a judge or even three judges because I usually know more about my case than they do, and I know more about the law than they do. But I don't have access to any more information about trends in marijuana case defense and new case law than anyone else in this room. But I do have one thing that works for me. I have the topic. And so to work up the topic, I got on the internet and looked at magazine articles and case law and talked to friends of mine. And we wind up with a 110-page outline, which you don't need to read while I'm talking. But I hope it covers things that, you know, on the plane on the way home or at some time you will find interesting. There are 8 subjects in the outline, and it's bait stamped on the lower right corner so that occasionally I'll mention page numbers today, not because I want you to turn to the page numbers, because that's the page number where the section on that topic begins. And those are just the first two headings in the outline that you can see up there. By way of sweeping information, NORMA was founded in 1970, which is the year that I became a lawyer. I didn't have a clue to what I wanted to do at that time, but I knew there were a lot of bad laws out there, and I kind of wanted to participate in doing something about them. And in particular, a substance called marijuana had been discovered, in my case, in the basement of a fraternity house at the New England College for Delinquent Boys. And we thought, man, this shit's going to be legal in 5 years. This is amazing. We weren't quite right about the five-year part, but Keith Tripp founded NORMA in 1970. That's now 45 years ago. That's when we began this journey. And, you know, the people of Israel wandered in the Sinai for 40 years. You know, how long can you get lost in a place like the Sinai? It's just a desert. I think the biblical message is that one generation has to pass on another generation to come forward, particularly when you're dealing with something, marijuana prohibition, that has really ruined many lives. The prohibition has ruined lives. People can't be lawyers and doctors and politicians because they have convictions for marijuana. From the old days, when I started practicing law, it was 2 to life in Texas. And a good deal was the 2-year probation, but that's still a felony conviction for many purposes, for many disqualifications of civil rights. So we really have come a long way, not in 5 years, but in 45. We have wandered along working together, defending people and trying to reform the law. And Keith Stroop is the person more than any other single individual that has made that possible. So where are we today? Well, I picked up Time Magazine, off the newsstand on the way here. This is the hottest news. The highly divisive, curiously underfunded, and strangely promising world of pot science. Yeah. The great pot experiment. Legalization keeps rolling ahead, but because of years of government roadblocks on research, we don't know nearly enough. So we are moving along. This is the trend. This is the national report. Every morning when I get back to the office from court, we usually start the morning at 8:30 in some courtroom somewhere. We come back mid-morning. And my second cup of coffee, I log on to the NACDL news service. If you don't belong to the National Association of Criminal Defense Lawyers, you might think about it. NACDL does a lot of things. And one thing NACDL does is send out a daily clipping service of what's happening, what's trending, what's going on. And as I'm drinking my coffee, I page through the headlines and the summaries and read the articles I like. For example, yesterday's news trending in the law, memo to federal workers, using marijuana could cost you your job. This is from the Washington Post. It turns out that The District of Columbia and 23 states have authorized adult use of medical marijuana. Of those, four states and the district allow recreational use. Marijuana became legal in the district, allowing anyone 21 and over to possess up to 2 ounces, although the drug is still prohibited on federally administered properties. However, the article from yesterday tells us that in 1986, Ronald Reagan issued an executive order saying federal employees may not smoke marijuana. And while there is still some limitation on how much marijuana testing goes on for federal employees, in many jobs they have it and some they don't, we still haven't caught up. We haven't, you know, taken a look at that law that Ronald Reagan put in effect in 1986. And then there is my beloved Texas legislature. Texas legislature wants to treat pot like tomatoes. David Simpson, conservative, Republican, Tyler, Texas, a place that did not even allow the sale of alcoholic beverages until 1980. David Simpson's bill to deregulate marijuana in Texas became an overnight sensation for his novel views. Simpson, a Republican state representative, says, "Everything that God made is good, even marijuana," he said in explaining his legislation, which he filed Monday in the state capitol. "The conservative thought is that government doesn't need to fix something that God made good." In a news release, Simpson said that he supported regulating marijuana like the state regulates tomatoes, jalapenos, and coffee. Now, they've got medical marijuana bills hot and live in the Texas legislature. It's probably not going to pass this session, but it's the trend. We can see what's happening. We're going from every case of felony to medical marijuana. We're playing catch up with the other states. And it is so important that the conservative, libertarian, small government, individual freedom, conservative wing, libertarian wing of our political thought, mostly the Republican Party, is moving in that direction. That's a good trend. Now, in the paper, the next thing I go off on is technology and science. Technology is important. We need to know all about it. Jury scrutiny of science in jury trials has been raised by crime scene investigation and similar cases. It's hard to get a jury in a marijuana case. I was called out for jury service in Harris County 6 months ago, and lo and behold, they sent me to a county court to try a marijuana possession case. They had to go through about 22 jurors to find 12 that were qualified so that each side could use 3 strikes and they could seat 6. They got to me. "Well, Mr. Millett, you have been an active criminal defense lawyer all your professional life." "Yes." "And you have defended many people charged with the same offense for which this defendant is charged." "That's true." "Well, we'd like to talk about you about your service." I said, "Don't worry, Your Honor." And I got to say those words that we all would like to say. I could set that aside, and I could be fair. So they had to use a strike. I did my duty. But on the subjects of science and technology, the big trend, as we know, has been this whole computer thing. I'll comment that the DWI bar has been created because lawyers worked hard to know the science of nystagmus and eye testing, the science of blood testing, the science of breath testing. It wasn't so many years ago that people had to litigate getting access to these breath test machines because law enforcement agencies had the monopoly and the companies wouldn't sell them to anybody else. But actually, the chance of a person going to trial and being acquitted for a driving under the influence case is better today than it was 20 years ago when you just relied on opinion testimony of arresting officers. That's because the lawyers went out and did the work. I remember being in trial in Arizona with Michael Black in Phoenix, a very fine lawyer. And we were talking about whether it's right and just that we should charge money, because obviously as much as we can. And he said, well, I was a prosecutor, and prosecuting was easy. You have the report. You put the officer on. You say, officer, and what happened next? But reasonable doubt is not in the offense report. Defense lawyers have to get out and go to the scene. They have to go to the jail. They have to talk to the witnesses. They have to study the science. As Barry Scheck says, we all need to become forensic science. Reasonable doubt is at night and on weekends and in the library and on the computer studying the internet. Now, in the outline, I go off for a while on the Special Operations Division of the Drug Enforcement Administration and the phishing gear, the telephone surveillance equipment that is commonly used, that they're spending millions and millions of dollars on. On pages 2 to 17 in the outline, I talk about the rise and demise of the SOD, which from 1992 to 2013 was collecting information and then telling law enforcement agencies to not give up the information, to keep it secret. And I go off on the phishing gear that is bought to, and the millions of dollars being spent on gear that will initially just locate where a cell phone is, but now can be used to actually intercept conversations on a cell phone. The Special Operations Division instructed people using DEA information to recreate the truth. That's an interesting phrase for telling a lie. To do reverse engineering for their investigations and offense reports. I like this, retroactive parallel investigations. Here's a Reuters article from 2013. A secretive U.S. DEA unit is funneling information from intelligence intercepts, wiretaps, informants, and a massive database of telephone records to authorities across the nation to help them launch criminal investigations. The DEA unit that distributes the information is called the Special Operations Division, or SOD. There are approximately 10,000 agents with access to information from the SOD. Key for us. Law enforcement agents said they don't worry that the SOD involvement will be exposed in court because most of the drug trafficking defendants plead guilty before trial and then never request to see the evidence against them. If cases do go to trial or trial is threatened, current and former agents said charges were sometimes dropped to avoid the risk of exposing SOD involvement. Now, the DEA claimed that in 2013 they stopped doing that. Do you believe it? Do you believe it? Can you trust your government? I don't know. There's a lot of equipment out there and a lot of people who know how to use it. I think that we've all had cases promoted through SOD tips and false reports. Short war story. Guy is driving an 18-wheeler north from Houston. Stopped by the Texas Department of Public Safety outside of Walker County. That's 80 miles north. 400 kilograms of cocaine. He's a Canadian citizen. My issue is, why is this guy stopped by a Department of Public Safety trooper who is working 150 miles from the jurisdiction where he is assigned to interdict traffic? At a hearing, he says, I got a very specific instruction from my commander. Wait for that truck and follow it until you get probable cause. The judge, a friend, Judge Jerry Sandel, we kind of grew up in the law together, him prosecuting, me defending, congratulated me for getting that far in my discovery and said we really ought to work this out so it didn't go any further. You know, normally 400 kilograms of cocaine in Texas will get you life or something close to it. It's a mandatory minimum 15. We pled for 8. I didn't know anything about the Special Operations Division. I now believe that I was getting close to the truth. The important practice tip from that case is a little bit different. The defendant was Canadian. They agreed not to oppose transfer to a Canadian prison. Think about this if you get a Canadian citizen. The sentence we agreed to would require service of at least 50%. That would be 4 years in the Texas prison. In Canada, they release you under the release laws of the United States of Canada, 25%. So he got out in 2 years, happily released almost as soon as the transfer papers could be worked out. And the reason I'm sure that case was an SOD investigation now with the benefit of hindsight was that a year and a half later, I got a call from the same Canadian lawyer about a case in Florida, and I got to go to Tampa and represent a truck driver who had a load of cocaine going north towards Canada, and he too was allowed to plead under favorable circumstances, and he too got prisoner exchange to Canada. So we don't really know how much of the casework we've been doing over the last few years was in fact infected by the reverse engineering false offense reports, retroactive parallel investigations of officers using tips from the Special Operations Division. The other topic I have up there under data collection is phishing gear. I think that's where that is.
Previous.
Okay. Well, previous or next?
There
you are. That's all this stuff. Now, the Harris Corporation, you can buy stock on the New York Stock Exchange. The Harris Corporation makes all of this stuff. They can steal data from telephones. And they call it phishing gear partly because the names of the equipment are all phishing names, Amberjack, things like that. The government says, well, these tools can also be used by foreign governments, that our national security requires the technology not be in the public domain, that we not know how the equipment works or able to get it and use ourselves. By contract, before Harris Corporation technological proprietary information will be disclosed, a case will be dismissed. That's in the papers. If you can get there, if you can get to the point where the technology is material to your probable cause, to the false information in an affidavit for a search warrant, for example, then you're getting danger, you're getting close to a posture where the government will be required to dismiss the case. We'll briefly mention three little tools on the subject of technology. Online investigation systems, the TLO, now TLO-XP. The probation office uses this. When you read a pre-sentence investigation report in federal court now, and they're going over the defendant's financial situation at the back of the report, they will have in there his automobile transactions and real estate transactions and boats and planes that he has owned. It's important that the client know that he not lie during the pre-sentence investigation report, because this information is available for $5, TLO-XP. You can register, get a username, and for $5 get a complete dossier on any individual. It's almost embarrassing to me to think of what kind of intrusive information is there. Criminal history, bankruptcies, real estate mortgages, liens on all forms of transportation, criminal history, relations, neighbors, all this information about you and about people in your cases is available for $5 over the TLO-XP online investigation system. That's how we know that we have a case of a Houston guy indicted in Brooklyn, and we've discovered that the case agent's mother lives in Brooklyn. At least we know how they established jurisdiction. In another case, we looked up the case agent and found, you know, it's personal stuff. The case agent is recently twice divorced, second divorce recent, single mother. It doesn't make the client innocent or defend the case, but it gives us some insight into what's going on. There's a tremendous amount of information out there available. Social networks, Facebook, Twitter, Snapchat. When you get a case and you understand, tell your client to take down everything that's out there, because the police are going to look at it. And if you know the identity of a sensitive witness, then go download what they have on their public social networking information. You might find, as my partner in the office did, in a sexual assault case, that the complainant had accused three other people of sexually assaulting her in the previous 4 years. That might be material. To see a man is to see someone who's going to be assaulting her. In one case, there was an investigation at Texas Tech University, and the accused was exonerated. So on the defending your client side, have the client take everything down. And on the investigating the case side, look up all the witnesses and get all the information that's available. Search engines, Google. Now, you know, I'm an old guy. I think you young people who've been to law school more recently probably know about Google Scholar. But I just learned about it a few months ago. I told my law student, I said, here's the title to a law review article. When you're at school next week, would you go print it for me at the Gold Library? I don't want to pay for it. And she said, I can get it in about 30 seconds. So you type in Google Scholar on the Google information box. That'll take you to Google Scholar. You then type in quotations the name of a publication, and it's there, free, almost instantly. News to me. So, tool for investigation. I used it in calling together the papers that I'm going through now. Polygraph. We've been hearing about polygraph all the time that we've been criminal defense lawyers. We've been suspicious of it, and at the same time, from occasionally we want to use it. Occasionally we have a client who says, you know, I didn't know about it, I wasn't there, I'll take a polygraph. We take the polygraph, and turns out, occasionally, he's telling the lawyer the truth. So,
imagine that.
Last week, a man named Doug Williams pled guilty. He was a polygraph examiner who was teaching people how to pass a lie detector test. When he was arrested last fall, this is reported in the New York Times Magazine, Doug Williams, a former Oklahoma City police detective, has for 36 years trained people to pass the lie detector test. The test assumes that an innocent person telling the truth will have a stronger reaction to control questions. He then tells them how to think about nice things when you hear a question that might raise your temperature, make you perspire, make your heartbeat faster. Think about, you know, waves crashing on the beach. And he has you practice with a polygraph to prepare yourself to pass the test. Likewise, if you want to show a reaction, you think about what's your greatest fear. Drowning, being buried alive, clench your anus. There are a number of things that he recommended in his training that people do in order to influence the results of the test. So they went after him. They sent in Justice Department agents, undercover agents, to say, I'm the two of them, separate cases. I'm a federal employee. I must pass the test. In one case, it was about smoking marijuana. In another case, it was about something else. I need to pass my test. They set him up. He was indicted in the fall. He pled guilty last week, but he's got 36 years of teaching people how to pass the polygraph test. Relevance. April 9, 2015, Mosquera case.
What's the crime?
Yeah, what's the crime?
Obstructing justice. He was teaching them how to lie, and they indicted him, and he pled to two obstruction counts. It's in the paper. Mosquera, April 9, 2015, Federal District Court, Tampa, holds polygraph admissible in that court, federal proceedings. It took off relying on some old 1998 11th Circuit law. So at least in Tampa, subject to the government's appeal or what happens at trial, polygraph is now admissible to impeach or corroborate if there's notice, if the opponent has an attempt to test or contest, and if you have the requisite Daubert, Comhotile foundation questions. Are the theories, methods, and techniques tested? Is it subject to peer review and publication? Error rate acceptable? Technique generally accepted in a scientific community? Testimony helpful to the jury? My theory about polygraph, it's inadmissible if it's going to be used against us. In Texas, in Harris County, they use polygraph to test compliance with conditions of probation. That's the one time our judges think it's admissible, or at least can be considered to revoke a probation. So if it helps us, it's admissible. If it doesn't help us, it's not reliable, it's too easy to cheat, shouldn't be used in a court. Designer drugs cases. Operation Synergy 1 and 2. Both nationally publicized sweeps of people selling synthetic marijuana, or so-called synthetic marijuana, and other substances. United States versus Fedido, important case in Florida, because they had a suppression hearing founded on extensive depositions. It's in the outline, pages 53 to 73. Jim Feldman took the depositions of experts. He put on defense experts. In a synthetic marijuana case, the government, in theory, would have the burden of showing the substance sold was chemically substantially similar to marijuana and that the effect was substantially similar. Now, how are they going to prove the second problem? They're not going to call in somebody to say, I smoked both and it was similar. So what they have intended to do is say, well, the effect is similar in terms of the science of how it strikes the brain, not into how it affects the feeling, the happiness, the grooviness of the guy that's taken it. In depositions, in Fedida, and there's a relevant section of the deposition in your papers, it was discovered that the way lookalike drugs get classified and scheduled by the Drug Enforcement Administration is that at the DEA lab, a little committee is who shows up from work that day, maybe five people, sits around and they have a discussion about what they have seen in their looking through the microscope, running the thin layer chromatograph, mass spectrometry, all that, and they just decide if it's substantially similar in its chemical structure and its effect as to how it hits on the brain. In the testimony, Terrence Booz, the head of the DEA crime lab, testified in the Fedida case in the deposition that is in your papers, and I'm looking at pages 64 and 65 right now, that it is impossible to say whether the materials that he tested had the same or greater stimulant, depressant, or hallucinogenic effects on the central nervous system in the human body as does marijuana. Miss Fedida, was allowed to plead out to a misdemeanor. The depositions in those cases are online. There's about 350 pages. The best part is the Terrence Booz cross-examination, which is in your papers in a smaller segment from that. But if you get a synthetic drug case, and they're bringing them all across the country in federal court pursuant to Project Synergy 1 and 2, then I recommend that you read the depositions. Now, what does it take to be criminally responsible? What is the intent requirement, the specific intent, particularly if you're selling an unscheduled substance? The circuits are in disagreement. The Fifth Circuit says it's strict liability. There's a case that was argued in the Supreme Court on April 23rd called McFadden versus United States, coming up from the Seventh Circuit, and the issue is whether a defendant to be criminally responsible has to have a specific intent to be selling a substance that violates the law. Because, as you know, these things are just in schedules, they're not in statutes, and we now know from McFadden that the DEA sits around and decides what to stick into the regulations. It appears from the argument in McFadden, a case that will come out within the next 30 days, that the standard will be raised. That is that in the case that we have in Texas, the prosecution's theory of culpability will have to be altered because they have to prove more. They have to prove, under our old Fifth Circuit standard, an intent to violate the law. That was probably not the Fifth Circuit standard, is probably not today. Watch McFadden in your designer drugs cases for what will be the required culpable mental state. I noted as I was looking through all of this that we have something coming new, and I stuck at the bottom, Palcohol. I don't know how this is going to go. They're now selling powdered alcohol. So if you go on a camping trip, you can just take a little thimble of it and mix it with the creek water and soothe yourself after a long day of hiking. CBS News, Palcohol, powdered alcohol may present serious health risks. Channel 13, Houston, Texas, 13 News investigates now dangers of powdered alcohol. Texas Tribune, Texas unlikely to ban powdered alcohol this session. We have an interesting conflict between the drug prohibition lobby, which sees the powdered alcohol as a dangerous drug. Don't you know children are going to sneak it into the football game and mix it with the Coca-Cola? And the alcohol lobby that wants to sell someone that they can make taste like strawberries. So watch in the trending case law on what happens with alcohol, powdered alcohol. What's next? Brady versus Maryland. Jerry Goldstein just came in. Last year, Goldstein and others worked together on a famous and wonderful case, freeing a man who was on death row for 27 years. And the tragedy was that the real killer got to run free for 27 years.
And killed someone else that he's now been convicted of.
And killed again.
Wow.
Now,
the judge went to jail, by the way.
I think that the judge went to jail. Because when the judge was the prosecutor, he failed to disclose evidence that might be helpful to the defense, to wit, a statement by the only eyewitness to a killing, a 4-year-old, 3-year-old boy, a monster did it, not daddy. So, there is a rising trend in the law towards greater sensitivity towards rights and interests under Brady versus Maryland. I want to talk about that briefly. Most prosecutors and judges think that Brady versus Maryland is a case which holds they must disclose evidence which says the defendant is innocent. Another person did it, acting alone, has confessed, and they believe the confession. That would be the common prosecutorial definition of Brady versus Maryland. But actually, Brady was a sentencing case. It had nothing to do with Mr. Brady's guilt. It was a murder case, and the issue was not whether Brady was a party to the murder and participated in the murder. He clearly did. The issue was who held the murder weapon and filed the killing shot. And a co-defendant confessed that he did it alone, not Brady. Under the context of the case, that was a sentencing issue only. Brady is a sentencing case. Brady, Kyles versus Whitley, the case that says that prosecutors have to ask the police to turn over everything that might help the defense. These cases have to do with the right to discover what is helpful to the defense. Now, true, prosecutors think that's a confession by another person that they did it acting alone, and the prosecutor thinks it's true. We think Brady means something close to the civil standard of a deposition. It might lead to relevant and admissible and helpful evidence. But Brady is only about what is helpful. Now, I go off in the outline to a specific example, this Sudikoff case, which is in the outline, a Ninth Circuit case, which holds that the whole set of papers created when a witness is being prepared, being polished up, is admissible. Under Sudikoff, a lawyer's proffer to the district attorney about what he thinks the client's going to say is admissible if it's in the district attorney's notes. Certainly, emails between law enforcement and a witness are admissible. Anything having to do with the evolution of testimony under Sudikoff is admissible. Now, what happens all too often in these Brady cases is the judge says, well, I'll look at it in chambers. Well, how does the judge know what use you might make? And by the way, by the time you get into the courtroom, it's a little bit too late. Not only is the judge ignorant, it's just dumb as a post, about how the defense might use the information, but by the time you're in the courtroom, it's too late anyway. So, look at Sudikoff, and look at the idea that a prior statement is not just admissible for possible impeachment under, in federal court, the Jinx Act, 18 U.S.C. 3500, but look at it from the standpoint that it might lead to relevant evidence. And in the materials, you will find an order in a case in which there is a listing of all the things that might be relevant to the bias or motive of a cooperating witness to testify favorably to the prosecution. And push your Brady rights pre-trial, and in particular, in the Sudikoff example, as giving you a right to discover notes from the successive interviews of a witness, from proffer sessions, the prosecutor's notes of what the attorney told him the client would say, a side deal between the prosecution and the defense lawyer is admissible because it might bear on the bias or motive of the client, of the lawyer. And think about how Brady is becoming increasingly available as a tool because the trend with the innocent projects and things like the Morton case are making judges sensitive to claims that law enforcement is in possession of material that might be helpful to the defense. Opinion testimony, drug slaying cases, and cases by officer that someone appeared to be high. This is an area discussed in the materials where I think we have been a little bit lax in letting prosecution lawyers put on testimony that tended to lower the standard of persuasion from beyond a reasonable doubt to by a preponderance of the evidence. The example in the materials had to do with a California case where the prosecutor wanted to call as a so-called expert a man to testify about how a pharmacist should behave in approving increasing amounts and repeated prescriptions for pharmaceutical painkillers. And he wanted to testify that certain acts by a pharmacist would raise a red flag, or that certain acts by a pharmacist would make him uncomfortable because it would show the possibility that the regulations were being ignored. Judge held that would tend to lower the prosecution's burden to show that when a defendant did those things, he was guilty of having criminal intent. It would tend to make a jury able to make a decision based on a preponderance of the evidence rather than proof beyond a reasonable doubt. So too in testimony about the opinions of an officer. We need to look at the case law and try to, by motion in limine or otherwise, keep out opinion testimony that would lower the standard of persuasion in a case. There's a list in the outline at pages 80 and 81 of case law where judges either suppressed evidence or on appeal, courts of appeal determined that judges should have suppressed evidence given by so-called opinion witnesses, opinions that got dangerously close to violating Federal Rule 704B's prohibition against a witness giving an opinion about the mental state of a defendant. So the case law is in there to help you restrict these drug slang and custom and practice of drug cartel witnesses that seem to be increasingly in vogue. I'm going to go back briefly, kind of in closing, to where I started. I commented that Keith started Normal 45 years ago. And seems like a long time. That's the amount of time between when the Enigma machine was invented to break the code that the Germans were using and the time that we built a machine where you could put all human knowledge on a single computer and stick it on a laptop. It was 45 years from the Montgomery bus boycott led by Martin Luther King until a man of color was elected and inaugurated as President of the United States. It was 45 years from the theory of DNA to the mapping of the human genome, the 5 billion sequence human genome. Now, these changes happened because Keith was here, you know. That's wonderful. All of these. And in particular, the marijuana law reform happened because Keith was here. But they also happened because of people working together.
He's also the reason why it took so long.
Yeah.
Some of you all know that story.
People working together. And while, you know, this is a finite number of people, we're all friends here in this room. Norma is all over the country. It's in other countries. We have a chapter in Houston, Texas that meets once a month. They have booths on outdoor parks. When there's a concert, there's a normal booth. I'm in Austin last week, and the legislature is meeting. They're talking about this Republicans' proposal that we treat pot like jalapenos, and Norman is out there with a big desk outside the Capitol giving out information. So, you know, we, in all of this, have shared in being a part of something bigger than we are, something we can tell our children, this is what we did when there were bad laws and they needed to be changed. And thank you all, and I'm proud to be a part of it too.